Weeks left for concluding the book of Genesis, and so you know that we've been in the life of Joseph, and so tonight we're going to pick up where we left off. And if you have your Bible, please open it up to the book of Genesis chapter 46, and we're going to try to get through a couple chapters here tonight to make sure that we can get through this and perhaps do a little bit of review. Last week we got to what you might want to call the climax when it comes to the account of the story of Joseph and his brothers. If you look at all that we've been through, the last three chapters has been probably the most emotional when it comes to the climax, where we see in chapter 44 we saw Joseph's final test of his brothers, and we saw Judah's emotional speech where he was willing to substitute himself to save his youngest brother Benjamin. And finally, last week in Genesis chapter 45, we saw the reconciliation with the brothers of Joseph, and we saw his brothers going back to Jacob to bring him and the rest of the family back to Egypt. And so last week we talked a little bit about the puzzle pieces that had come together, everything that God had prophesied, all the promises that he'd looked forward to. We see most of the fulfillment of that in the chapter we looked at last week. And you might recall, we ended with Jacob at the very end of chapter 45. He gets this incredible report. Joseph was alive after 20 plus years. He's the second ruler over Egypt. He wants the whole family to move to Egypt. He's going to care for all of them. And we mentioned last week, probably somewhere in there, his brothers had to reveal their part in how Joseph got to Egypt in the first place. And it says there that, you know, Jacob's heart fainted. We noted last week, well, no wonder his heart fainted to get all of this information. But at the end, when the wagons came with all the supplies that Joseph had sent, he believed it and he was willing to go. And so that brings us to chapter 46. And we're going to go ahead and get right into that here tonight. Somebody once said that for the ignorant, old age is winter, but for the learned, it's a harvest. Jacob is somebody that's learned some pretty hard lessons in his life. He's made some mistakes. He's done some good things. He's done some bad things. Now he has the chance to see some good choices at the end of his life. So let's read the first several verses. Let's just start with the first four verses. Brian, would you mind reading that?
46.
Chapter 46, the first four verses.
So Israel set out with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, Here I am. He said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again. And Joseph,
okay, so it's interesting as we begin chapter 46, and we see the name Israel. You've noticed, you know, Jacob was renamed Israel, kind of his spiritual name, and we've seen the name kind of used interchangeably since then. But it starts off by talking about Israel beginning his journey, and it says that he took everything that he had. Now, I think living today, for you and me to get the idea of having a journey like this, this is kind of beyond, you know, what we can think of. You know, to gather up everything that he might have, I don't know what that must have been like at that time, but this is quite a thing. Traveling 250, 300 miles, this is not an easy journey. It does make me wonder. It says he was taking with him all that he had. Flip back a page in your Bible to chapter 45 and verse 20. What did Pharaoh say when he talked about them coming in chapter 45 and verse 20?
Don't bring anything.
Don't bring anything. We'll take care of you. You don't need to bring anything. And so Jacob may have some doubts here about that, doesn't the Pharaoh saying this? He's bringing everything. And it says that when he came to Beersheba, he offered sacrifices to the God of his father, Isaac. Now, this is one of those passages that we could just kind of skim on by. And yeah, he was on the way, and yeah, he stopped at Beersheba, and yeah, he offered a sacrifice, and then he kept on going. But I think that there's some significance to him stopping there. So he started up here in Hebron, and he stops here at Beersheba, and he offers the sacrifice to God. You've heard me mention this here a few times in this class. Where have we heard Beersheba before? Can you think of any other things that occurred or people when you hear the name Beersheba? Is this a familiar place? Okay. Isaac spent some time there. He lived there, didn't he? Isaac lived at Beersheba. So his father lived there. Okay. What else? Sometimes we go through these things and these little names are mentioned, and when you put it all together, it's kind of interesting to see what this must have meant when Jacob stopped at Beersheba. I just put some of it together here. So Beersheba, what are all the things? Well, remember, that's where Abraham dug a well and planted the tamarisk tree. This is the same place. So he's stopping at Beersheba. This is the same place where Abraham lived after he almost offered Isaac. So this is a very familiar place. As was mentioned, this is where Isaac had lived. More personally to Jacob, this was the place that he left when he went to Laban's, his uncle, to go find a wife. So in many ways, this was kind of his childhood home. This is where he had been, the last place he had been really before he left for all those years with his uncle Laban. It was at Beersheba that God appeared to Hagar, that God appeared to Isaac. And so this is a significant place for him to stop at Beersheba. And the last thing I would note about Beersheba, if you go back to the map that we had up here earlier, is just the location of it, is pretty much when you leave Beersheba, you're leaving the promised land. It's almost like once you're going past Beersheba, you're on the way. And so Jacob stops at this last point, kind of the point of no return, and he worships God, and he offers a sacrifice to God. So it's interesting that that's what he chooses to do. And how does it describe God in verse 1? It says the God of his father Isaac. It's interesting that it doesn't just say God, but it's referring back to the God of his father Isaac. It's almost like Jacob is coming back and remembering all these things that have happened. Some of his faith is returning. So interesting as we see that. So you have to think Jacob has a lot of things going through his mind. He's taking this journey. He's taking everything that he has. This is an old man. This is not a young man by any means. And I think he must need some reassurance, because as Brian read, we see God speaks to him in a vision and calls his name, you know, Jacob, Jacob. Kind of reminds you of there's been some other times back in chapter 22, God said, Abraham, Abraham, at a time when he needed some reassurance. And so we see this response. I always find it funny in the text when they say, here I am, as if, you know, God needed to, oh, there you are. But that they identify, well, here I am, Lord. And he goes on and he gives some reassurance there in the last couple of verses. Somebody tell me, how would you sum up the reassurance that God offers to Jacob in those two verses? What is God telling Jacob in verses 3 and 4? God's going to be with him. He may be going to a foreign land, but God is going to be with him. The God of your fathers.
It's directly related to the promises. He tells him about, he says, even though this is happening, you're still going to be a great nation.
Yeah, you have to think, Jacob's thinking, wait a minute, the promised land is back the other way. So God has to say, hey, wait a minute, this is all part of my plan. This is all reassurance that he needed. So he gives them, number one, I'm going to make you a great nation in Egypt. This is all part of that plan. This is all part of that puzzle that we're talking about. I got a picture painted at the end that is going to be amazing. Number two, I'm going to be there with you. Number three, I'm going to bring you back to Canaan again. Now, you may not be alive, but you're going to come back to Canaan again. And number four, he gives him some reassurance that's probably even more special to him. Your son Joseph, the one that you haven't seen for the 20-plus years, he's going to close your eyes when you die, which was something that at that time was customary when someone died, that they would close their eyes. And so this is something that is exactly what he needed to hear. Now, when you think about Jacob, there's a lot of reasons that he might have feared going to Egypt prior to this, but this is exactly what he needed to hear. It is. We're going to talk more about that in a minute, but Mike was just saying, if you didn't hear that, you know, Egypt had this caste system, and so for them going there, it wasn't like they could be part of, like, hey, we're moving into the neighborhood kind of a thing. It was going to be very difficult. How are they going to fit in? He didn't understand that at this point. And yet it's all part of God's plan. It's interesting how God worked it out. Now, we're setting the stage for Travis's class in the book of Exodus as we get here, but keep your finger here and flip ahead to Exodus chapter 1. One of the nice things about this is we know the end of the story. You know, we know what actually took place. But in Exodus chapter 1 and verse 5, we get a picture of where the nation ended up at the beginning of the book of Exodus. Verse 5, it says, "And all the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70 in number." We're going to read them in a minute. "But Joseph was already in Egypt, and Joseph died, and all his brothers and all that generation. But the sons of Israel were fruitful, and increased greatly, and multiplied, and became exceedingly mighty, so that the land was filled with them." Exactly as God predicted, exactly as God said, and we'll talk more in a minute, that this is exactly the plan, perfect. God was setting the stage for the nation to become what it became, in Exodus chapter 1. Begins with that. Any comments or questions there as we leave the first four verses of chapter 46? All right. Next couple verses there, beginning in verse 5. It says, "Then Jacob started out from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried out their father Jacob, their little children, and their wives in the wagons that Pharaoh had sent along to transport him." This is not an easy journey for a man of Jacob's age. "Jacob and all his descendants took their livestock and their possessions they had acquired in the land of Canaan, and they went to Egypt. He brought with him to Egypt his sons and grandsons, his daughters and granddaughters, all his descendants." And so they complete the journey, and they make it to Egypt. Now, in the next verses, as you look through the rest of this chapter, if we take a look at verses 8 through 25, I'm not going to actually read every verse of that text, but as you can tell by looking at it, it says in verse 8 that these are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt, Jacob and his sons. And so we got a list of all these names, and I'm not listing all the names, but I will list for you. You may recall we did list the lineage as far as the children of Jacob and some of the later lineage. I don't have all those names up on the screen, but This is recorded, inspired by the Word of God. We've talked about this before. Why is it important that these names are recorded for us for all time? Now we're reading all of these names. What is it about these names that it's important that we know? Okay. Shows how prophecy was fulfilled to a certain extent. Okay. In that way, what you're saying is you see the nation beginning to build and then being fruitful. Okay. I know what some of the ladies want to say is that there's some great baby names in this list. I mean, I know some of you have considered in verse 21, Muppim, Huppim, and Ard, some of the best biblical names ever. That's one of the reasons I think that's here. Not really. But. What else? Why are these names here? Most importantly, at the end of the day, you know, I look to the Matthew chapter 1, and you know, we in Matthew chapter 1, we go through Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah. We've talked about Perez by Tamar, and you keep on going down the line until we get to Jesus. We do see part of that in these names, and so that's maybe another reason that these names are there. A couple things, just as you take a look here, a couple things. You'll notice that all of the males are named, not the females, except for Jacob's daughter, Dinah, in verse 15. But as you go through this, you'll see in verses 8 to 15, that's the lineage through Leah. 16 to 18 is Zilpah. 19 to 22 is Rachel. And 23 to 25 is Bilhah, the two wives, two concubines. But I want you to think about the very first readers of Genesis. You remember Moses wrote the book of Genesis. And you remember they're reading this as they're preparing to go into the promised land. What would this mean to them? Would these names have more meaning to them? This would be today, and I'm not. This is not an exact comparison, but are there some family names in this congregation where you can think there's some lineage going back? There's some names, and you can think, I know there's some history here. When I hear the family name, if I hear Watkins, or I hear Bird, or I hear other I know there's some history, there's some lineage. I have some familiarity with those names. When they heard these names, when they looked through, and they didn't just see the sons of Joseph, but they saw their children, every tribe, every family group, they were part of these family groups. And these family groups, I mean, you remember when they settled later in the promised land, they settled in these tribes. And so when they read this, this meant something to them more than it meant even to you and me when they read this. And so that's, I think, another reason why it was there. And it would identify the people who were reading this. They would say, hey, that's my family. This is God's people. I'm part of that. That's my lineage right there. That name, that's me. I think that's one of the reasons that was there. So, Steve?
This whole story is going to become about the 12 tribes, even more so. We focus on these 12 tribes, these men. And then I think we got a list of people that went into Egypt, and God's saying, one of the promises, I'm going to make you a great nation. Do we want to read the list of the people that came out? This list is tiny. It's minuscule compared to the list that's going to come out. And so that had to be very impactful to them. Look at what we are now compared to what went in.
How many people are listed here? 70 people. In Exodus chapter 1 and verse 5 that we read a minute ago, it says 70 people. It restates the same number. Does anybody know about how many people did the nation of Israel number when they were leaving Egypt? There were over 2 million people. So we're going to see that be fruitful and multiply. You better believe it. We're going to see that exponentially. So this meant something even more to the people of Israel as they were reading that. And so that, let's jump down. I'm not going to go through each one of those names, although I do like some of the unique names that are listed there. Let's just jump down here to verse 28. It says, Jacob sent Judah before him to Joseph to accompany him to Goshen. So they came to the land of Goshen. Joseph harnessed his chariot and went up to meet his father Israel in Goshen. When he met him, he hugged his neck and wept on his neck for quite some time. Israel said to Joseph, "Now let me die, since I've seen your face and know that you are still alive." This is the fifth time that we see Joseph weeping in the book of Genesis. Here he is, the prime minister of Egypt. He's in a high position. He probably looks very different than all of these Jewish shepherds in his family who are now coming to see him. And he doesn't hold back at all. He weeps on his father's neck, it says in my translation, for some time. And finally, we see this reunion. Verse 28 also kind of gives us a little bit of an indication that perhaps Judah has come up a level in Jacob's mind because of how he's acted. He's again kind of taking the place where Jacob is trusting him. He's the one that's sent ahead. And so he's put in kind of a place of prominence here. Verse 31, so Joseph said to his brothers and his father's household, "I will go up and tell Pharaoh, my brother, my father's household, who are in the land of Canaan, have come to me. The men are shepherds. They take care of livestock. They have brought their flocks and their herds and all they have. Pharaoh will summon you and say, 'What is your occupation?' Tell him, 'Your servants have taken care of cattle from our youth until now, both we and our fathers, so that you may live in the land of Goshen. For everyone who takes care of sheep is disgusting to the Egyptians.'" Now, why at the end of the chapter do you think it's important that it's recorded for us that Joseph told his brothers, make sure when you see Pharaoh that you tell him that your occupation is to take care of livestock or being a shepherd? Why would he even tell them that? Wouldn't that be obvious? Why is this recorded here for us? What do you think? Very specific instructions from Joseph to his brothers is what to say.
He was separated from the Egyptians.
Okay. Going into this, it's revealed right at the end when it says, everyone who takes care of sheep is disgusting to the Egyptians. They don't want anything to do with people who were doing that. They were more into what they grew and the granary and those kind of things. But that was one of the reasons, was to keep them separate. We're going to see that in just a minute. Jay?
It's probably well known that the Egyptians don't like shepherds. And given Joseph's brother's propensity for lying, he might be compelled to lie about it. And he dealt with harshly.
Yeah, in many ways, maybe it's Joseph saying, now be honest. Tell the truth. Now, again, as you said, maybe they knew, hey, shepherds are not exactly well-liked in Egypt. Joseph saying, tell the truth, because I want you to live in the land of Goshen, which is not very far from where Joseph was living now. But the end result of this is it results in the Israelites living separate from the Egyptians and developing in a very different way. So we read earlier Exodus chapter 1, and it talked about what they had become, and they'd become very powerful. They'd become very separate. It doesn't seem like they had assimilated at all with the nation of Egypt. This is something we don't think about very much, but Joseph was so faithful. Do you think Joseph was ever tempted by all the things that surrounded him in Egypt? Do you think he was ever tempted to be more like the Egyptians with all the, think of all the gods that they worshipped? I mean, even the very name of the pharaohs represented things that Joseph was against.
I don't think so. I mean, he had everything. He knew it was from
We don't have any evidence that he did anything, but certainly there was opportunities around him. That's for sure. I agree with you. Who is his wife, by the way? His daughter, I mean his wife, was the daughter of an Egyptian priest. Do you think that anything ever came up in conversation at home about that? I'm just saying, I think Joseph was a very faithful person. I don't disagree with Brian at all, but let's not forget that he still had temptations around him. He may not have acted on them, he may not have ever had an issue, but he certainly had them surrounding him. And so you have to think that when he is telling his brothers, we want to make sure that you're separate, that there's some point in that. By the way, if we go back to the lineage and the names that we read, did some of his brothers intermingle in the past with other people? Actually listed there in verse 10, the sons of Simeon, and notice it puts one of them there, it says the son of a Canaanite woman. It actually points it out, you know, and we see that in other places as well. Brian? I think you're right, and you're going to see the way he reacts to them here in the next chapter, that as soon as they say what they are, he immediately gives them this responsibility. So maybe Joseph just knew, okay, I'm going to, and I don't think that's how anybody else would have been treated, but Joseph knew because of his standing. I think you're right. So it's providential that God placed them in Goshen. They're separated from the Egyptians who detested most of their practices. It would prevent intermarriage. It would keep their nation pure. Again, we see God's providence at work here in chapter 46. Let's take a look here at chapter 47. And let's see here. Let's just read the first six verses as now we see Jacob's family settling here. Rocky, you want to read that for me? Let's do the first six verses of chapter 47.
And Joseph went in and told Pharaoh and said, my father and my brothers and their flocks and their herds and all they have come out from the land of Canaan. And behold, they are in the land of Goshen. He took five men from among his brothers and presented them to Pharaoh.
Okay, so at least through verse 6, I don't have a whole lot to add to that. They do exactly what Joseph says. Pharaoh responds by giving them the best land, and really in verse 6, puts them in charge of my livestock. That's quite a promotion. They're going from resident aliens, kind of coming in as foreigners here, to you're going to take care of my livestock. Only because of the standing of Joseph and the providence of God could we see that happening. Let's take a look here at verses 7 through 10. Dad, you want to read that for me?
Then Joseph brought in his father Jacob and set him before Pharaoh. Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Jacob, how old are you? And Jacob said to Pharaoh, the days of the years of my pilgrimage were 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life. They have not changed the days of the years of the life of my fathers, and the days
read verse 7, you know, so it's, you think that Pharaoh had wanted to meet the father of Joseph. Is there anything that jumps out at you in verse 7 that seems odd? Jacob being the one to bless Pharaoh, why does that seem odd? Yeah. You think it'd be the opposite? I mean, just think of the imagery of this shepherd, this bearded guy coming in that probably looked very humble, coming into the royalty of Pharaoh and blessing him. Hebrews chapter 7 and verse 7 says, the lesser is blessed by the greater. That's always what we see. And so it's interesting here that Jacob, maybe because he's older, but also because of somebody who's experienced the promises of God, he blesses Pharaoh. I think that when we read his response to the interpretation of the dreams, he seemed to make references to God, that he knew that it was coming from Joseph's God. And that's the only evidence I know of that suggests he was impressed by that. But beyond that, I don't know. He had to think something was amazing, but I think Joseph's character probably was a big part of it as well. John? Look what Joseph did with the famine. Look at the results. And it may be, Brian, that he also saw the results. I mean, everything he said came true. Here they are 2 years into the famine, and they've got more than they need. The results have proven themselves. So that's about all I can answer to that I know. The only other evidence I just thought of is going back to the book of Exodus chapter 1. Is we read verses 5 through 7, but verse 8 says, now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And it seems to suggest that there was also something about Joseph that, you know, that he believed him. It's also interesting that as you look in the book of Exodus, as soon as Pharaoh begins to mistreat the people of Israel, we're going to see things in Egypt going very bad, very quickly. So that's kind of interesting as well. Pharaoh is treating the people of God well. Egypt is being blessed. So kind of interesting to see that as well. He gave credit to his God. Absolutely. Jay?
God told Jacob he was going to go down to Egypt with him. Right?
Right.
I can't help but compare the similarities between Egypt being blessed or Jacob blessing Pharaoh and then multiplying the land. And the similarities of that and the Ark of the Covenant, remember it was outside of
wherever the presence of God was, the blessing followed. Is that what you're saying? No, I think that's an interesting parallel. Well, let's take a look here to see the Pharaoh's questioning of Jacob. And it's interesting, you know, the first question he asked, how many years have you lived? Now, is that a very polite question to ask today? How old are you? Now, do you think Jacob looked old? How old are you? How many years have you lived? Now, at that time, I think it was probably a sign of respect and showing how many years that he'd lived on the earth. But I want you to notice Jacob's answer. When you read Jacob's answer in verse 9, does that sound like a real positive answer? Does he say, I've had a wonderful life, 130 years? What's he say? Yeah, let me tell you about my life. They've been few. Yeah, we hear that say, 130, few. What's he talking about? Well, from his perspective, how long did Abraham live? 175. How long did Isaac live? He was about 180, but pretty close. So to hear this, he's thinking, well, you know, I'm only 130. I have not attained the years. He seems to feel like death is near. And so few have been my years. Unpleasant have been the years of my life. Unpleasant? You think he's had an unpleasant life? We spent some time talking about that and his dysfunctional family, but this guy did have a tough life, didn't he? What were some tough things that happened in his life? He lost his wife. He lost his son for all those years. Now, this is before my time, but you know, many years ago they had this show, This Is Your Life. So let's just say this is Jacob, and they're asking him, how long have you lived? And he's saying, well, it's been a tough life. What was going through his mind when he said it's been a tough life? Jacob, this is your life. What kind of things have you had happen? I went through this, and I was remembering all the things that happened, and when you see them all, I'm going to guess that Jacob probably looked all 130 years. So look at this. The very first thing we read about Jacob was he's struggling in the womb with his brother. That's the very first thing we read about. The second thing we read is he's raised by dysfunctional parents. We have favorites. We have scheming behind the scenes. We spent some time studying that, but not exactly a great example. He stole his father's blessing, and he's forced to leave his family because of the hatred of Esau. He's so fearful that Esau is going to kill him that he goes off somewhere else. Pretty stressful beginning to his life? I'd say so. Does it get any better? No. He spends years in exile serving his uncle Laban, who repeatedly cheats him. Life's just getting better all the time. So, you know, he meets the woman that he loves. He planned to marry one wife, but he ends up with four. And to Mike's point, I'll just say it caused continual strife. It did not go well. And we read about that strife. We read about the problems. He finally flees from his uncle. His uncle's so upset and even chases after him. You remember at the end of the chapter, they had to sign kind of this agreement that said, hey, we won't fight each other. Again, kind of a stressful situation. Things are pretty rough. His only daughter, Dinah, was raped or violated at Shechem. Not a horrible situation. He lived in fear of reprisal from Shechem's neighbors when his men and his sons, a couple of them, go and kill all the men of Shechem. And so you have to know he lives in fear of that. He loses his favorite wife, Rachel, at an early age. His oldest son, Reuben, lays with one of his concubines. His favorite son, Joseph, was tragically lost and presumed dead. And so for these 20-plus years, all the time, he thinks that his son has been violently killed. I can't imagine what that must have been like as a parent to think that your son was killed and was killed tragically. And now, right before all this occurred, he's on the verge of losing everything because of a famine. They don't have enough food to eat. And so when you see what it says in the text, it's been an unpleasant life. It kind of gives you a different perspective, doesn't it? He's had some rough times. So, John?
You missed he had his hip dislocated.
Yeah, I didn't put that one in there. Wrestling with God had his hip dislocated because it ended up well. But yeah, you could put some more things in there too, couldn't you? Yeah, every time he limped, perhaps, if he had a limp the rest of his life, perhaps he looked back on that event. I did not put that one in there. So this is a guy that had a life of more sorrow than joy. And he describes that here. And he says, it's interesting, at the very end of verse 9, he says, "Attained the years that my fathers lived during the days of their sojourning," of their passing through this life. Just kind of gives a perspective of how he views this life. And then it ends with, again, he blesses Pharaoh, and he goes out from his presence. So just interesting to see how he handles that. All right, I got at least, let's just read a few more verses in the 1 minute we have left here. In the verses that follow, I'm not going to read all of these. We're going to see that the land of Goshen is going to be given to them. And one of the things that we're going to see when the land is given to the Egyptians is if you read those following verses, it seems that the Egyptians become poor as Jacob and his relatives are doing okay. You don't read anything about their struggling. But if you look at the text, all the grain is used. And in verse 15, it says, "When all the money was spent in the land of Egypt, the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, 'Give us food, for why should we die in your presence? Our money's gone.' Joseph said, 'Give up your livestock, I'll give you food for your livestock, since your money's gone.' So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them food in exchange for horses." By the way, that's the first time horses is mentioned in the Bible. "And the flocks and the herds and the donkeys, and he fed them with food in exchange for all their livestock that year. When that year ended, they came to the next year and said, 'We'll not hide from the Lord that all our money is spent. The cattle are my Lord's. There's nothing left from my Lord except our bodies and our lands. Why should we die before our eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for food. So give us seed that we may live and not die, and that the land may not be desolate.'" Basically, at the end of this, we see the Egyptians essentially are selling themselves into servitude to Pharaoh to feed themselves. We'll pick it up here as the result of the famine in verse 20.